Well, thank you for coming. I didn't expect there to be anybody here at all. I want to invite you back somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 years. And here you are in the midst of lectures, practical sport, music, socializing, whatever else you're doing today. I don't really know you at all. I have no idea what's going on or why you're here. I'm rather surprised, as I say, that you are here. But the title of this talk is Rough Justice. Do we live in a well-run world? I'm not going to give an answer to that question. But what I want to do is to invite you to join with me in seeing how the Bible asks the question. And I want to invite you into this great book, the book of Job in the Old Testament. Before we do that, let me start with something contemporary. 10 days before I began to preach through the book of Job in the church where I serve, a policeman was stabbed and killed in Manchester. A man called Stephen Oak. This was January last year. He was making an arrest of someone suspected of terrorist offences. Why was he stabbed and killed? Well, obviously he was stabbed and killed because someone was resisting arrest and they stabbed him. But if anybody's running the world, if there is anybody running the world, if it isn't just chugging along at random, why was he killed? He was a right-living man. You may remember seeing his widow, Leslie, on television and in the papers, his 16-year-old son, his 14 and 12-year-old daughters, bereaved. He was a right-living man. He was a Christian, actually. You might say, well, why didn't his God protect him? Why, if I can just put it a little bit provocatively, wasn't some other policeman in the Manchester police force killed? Maybe a corrupt policeman who'd been putting people in prison unfairly, or someone cheating on his neighbor's wife, or something like that. Surely there should have been somebody else who, even with rough justice, deserved it more than he did. Well, it's a difficult question, isn't it, for anybody who thinks the world ought to be well run. Now, of course, some people don't think the world ought to be well run. Some people think the world does just carry on at random, in which case it's not a problem. Except that even those people have a gut feeling that things ought to be fair. There's something in all of us, isn't there, that when we see something unjust, there's something rises up in us and says, that's not fair. It ought not to be like that. And if we think the world chugs along without anybody running it, it's worth asking where we get that sense from, that it ought to be fair, even though it doesn't seem to be. Now, you've got on your handout the beginning of the Old Testament book of Job, which is a fascinating and very puzzling book. And I'm going to take us through the first chapter and the first part of the second chapter this week. Look, if you will, on the back of the handout before we launch into the beginning of this. On the back of the page headed Beginning the Book of Job, I've put down four markers, as I've called them. Job, as we'll see when he's introduced, is blameless. The Satan, who we'll also meet in the account, has influence. God is in control, and God gives terrible permissions. And I mention those up front at the beginning, so that as we get into this fascinating book, we'll see how the writer gives us those markers at the beginning. I've also put one question, and the question is Job a real believer? And we'll see that that's a key question in this book. So let's launch in the first section, the first five verses, which introduce Job. If you'd like to turn to the front again. There was a man in the land of Uz, nobody knows where that was, could be anywhere, whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. So right at the beginning, our writer signals to us that first marker that Job is blameless. That doesn't mean that he was perfect. It means that he lived an upright life, he had a clear conscience before God, and when he did things wrong, he put them right, and he turned from them. So that's who he was, and that's signaled right at the beginning. So not surprisingly, there were born to him loads of sons and daughters, and he had lots of wealth, verse 3, loads of sheep and camels and so on. He was a very, very wealthy man. Verse 3, he was the greatest of all the people of the East. So right at the beginning, we have a picture of a well-run world. And we ought to be saying to ourselves, well, if somebody's going to be wise, as this man was, and turn away from evil, it's not surprising that he'll be healthy and wealthy. Verse 4, his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, that may be his birthday, and they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them, and they'd have a great family party. And verse 5, when the party was over, Job would send and consecrate them, that is to say, he would make sure that they were right with God, and he'd rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings. Now, of course, it's set a long time ago and far away, but the picture at the beginning is of a man who really cares about living right in God's world, and everything's going well for him up to verse 5. And then, in very quick succession, and it is the most brilliant storytelling, the account of Job's life continues with four quickly succeeding scenes. First of all, we have a scene in heaven, or in God's throne room. Then we have scene two on earth, where Job is. Then we go back to heaven, or God's throne room, and then we go back to earth, where Job is. And I want us to see how the account develops. Verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God, that is to say spiritual beings, came to present themselves before the Lord in capital letters, meaning the God of the Bible. And Satan also came among them. And properly speaking, it's the Satan. It's a title. And it means something like the enemy or the accuser, the hostile one. So there he is. And picture, if you will, a kind of celestial cabinet meeting. And God is in the chair presiding over this cabinet meeting, and all the various spiritual powers in the universe are there. They've turned up, including this strange accuser, this enemy. Verse 7, the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? Now that may be a hostile question, that he was gate crashing, who let you in? Or it may just be, will you please give your report on your last week at work? But whatever it is, the Satan answered the Lord and said, we're just doing stuff. That's verse 7, going to and fro on the earth, walking up and down on it. It's a slightly evasive answer. I've just been doing my stuff. And then the Lord says to Satan, verse 8, have you considered my servant, which is a title of honor in the Bible, Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns from evil? So for the second time in 8 verses, we're told that Job is blameless. We've been told it by the writer in verse 1, and now we're told it in verse 8 on the lips of God himself. Have you considered him? And God draws Satan's attention to this man, who is so conspicuously right and right living and godly. He says, have you noticed him? And Satan answered the Lord and said, ha, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. So the Satan says to God, Job isn't a real believer. He's just in it for what he can get out of it. It's not surprising, he says, he bows down to you and worships you. After all, he's got all these sheep and cattle and all these sons and daughters, and he's very rich and healthy and happy. So he's just a fair-weather believer. He's not a real believer, is he? Ha. But, verse 11, stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, that's his possessions, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, and this is very shocking, behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him don't stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now, that's scene one. And I want us to notice on scene one these different markers. We've seen the uprightness of Job. Secondly, we've seen that the way this story is told, God is in control. Did you notice how this Satan figure, whoever he is, When he comes into the cabinet meeting, he has to ask permission before he can touch Job. I wonder if there's anyone here who's read that, what was some years ago, a best-selling book by Harold Kushner. It was called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Did anybody read it? It was a very popular book about 7 or 8 years ago, I think. It's a brilliant title, although the book, as I shall say, I think was less good. When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And Harold Kushner solves the problem of unfair suffering by saying, in effect, God is doing his best, but he's not really in control. And the picture in that book is that it's not really God's fault if innocent people suffer in the world, because we mustn't expect God to be in absolute control. That's quite a common solution nowadays. Even in some Christian circles, you come across that. Sometimes you come across the idea that God is like a chess grandmaster. You know those wonderful competitions where you get a grandmaster who takes on a dozen or so chess players and walks around and has a quick look at the board and plays a move and plays a move. And usually the grandmaster beats them all, but you can never be quite sure, because sometimes they'll slip up and somebody will win. And sometimes people say God is like that. He really is doing his best. He's very, very good at his job, but he's not absolutely in control, and we can't really blame him that sometimes he slips up. Now, the book of Job, like the rest of the Bible, won't allow that, because the Satan, even though he has influence, and as we'll see, it's pretty vicious, even though he has influence, he has to ask permission. He says, I want to touch what Job has, his possessions and his family. And only when God says, yes, okay, go and touch it, his possessions and his family, but don't touch him, only then can he do that. So you've got the markers there. Now, the next scene on earth, if you'd like to turn over the page, is a terrifying staccato succession of tragedies. Verse 13, there was a day when Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, so they were having one of these family parties. And there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were ploughing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans, who were people from South Arabia, fell on them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. So the first disaster is by crime or terrorism, as we would say. Verse 16, while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, and this one's a natural disaster, or as we would say loosely, an act of God. The fire of God, that is lightning, fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And then verse 17, while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the Chaldeans, that is from Babylon, formed three groups, made a raid on the camels, took them, struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, I alone have escaped to tell you. So the third one was crime or terrorism. Verse 18, while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people and their dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. It's punchy and horrible, isn't it? In this quick staccato succession of four disasters, Job loses his wealth and his family. He's bereaved of all his children. And he's desolate, verse 20. He tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground, and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Now, so far, it looks like the Satan is losing his bet with God. Do you remember that bet the Satan had with God? He said to God, I bet you he's not a real believer. I bet you that when it's tough, he's not going to worship you anymore or bow down to you. And so far he does. But of course we want to turn the next page, don't we? We want to see how is this going to pan out, because it's just a little bit too simple so far. So we go back to heaven, chapter 2, verse 1, for scene 3. And this is very, very similar to the first scene. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. This is a way in Bible imagery of speaking about the spiritual forces in the universe. And there they are, there for the next cabinet meeting. And the Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, where have you come from? And Satan said, just doing stuff. It's all the same as before, isn't it? And the Lord said to Satan, verse 3, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? Just pause there. That's the third time we've been told that Job is upright and blameless. Verse 1 of chapter 1 by the storyteller, verse 8 of chapter 1 on God's lips, and now again we've been told it. It's as though the storyteller is saying to us at the beginning of this book, I really want you to understand that this man does not deserve what's coming to him and what came to him. And he hammers it home three times, and as we'll see next week, it's very important that he did. So verse 3 continues. God says he still holds fast his integrity. You've seen that at the end of the last scene. Although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. That's an extraordinary verse. Extraordinary thing to say, isn't it? Here is God who is in control. He's in the chair. Nothing can happen without his permission. And he says to the Satan, you've got real influence, and you've incited me to destroy him without reason. And because you incited me, he's had all these disasters. So here's a picture of a world in which there is a God in control, who is good, but there is a Satan, an enemy, who has real influence. They're not equal and opposite. It's not what's sometimes called dualism. You know, forces of light and darkness battling it out, and you never quite know who's going to win. It's God in control, but real forces of evil, real personal evil in this world. So that's the Bible picture. Now, where have we got to? Verse 4. Now, Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Nobody knows quite what that imagery is, but it's a sort of pah. I'm not very impressed, says the Satan. All that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he's in your hand, only spare his life. So now it goes one stage further, and this is, it's very shocking, isn't it? I hope if you're not a Christian believer, or if you are a Christian believer, I hope that we're all shocked by this portrait of how the world is run. Here is somebody who Christian people believe is running this world well, who says to this enemy, okay, you can take his possessions and you can let him bury his children. And then the enemy says, that's not nearly enough to prove that he's a real believer. And instead of God saying, no, that's quite enough, that's more suffering than most people are asked for in their lifetime, God says, all right, you can attack his health. Very shocking, isn't it? This is the Bible portrait of the way the world is run. So verse 7, we go rapidly into the final scene. Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. I don't know what it was, but it was obviously some very distressing physical ailment. And he took a piece of broken pottery with him to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. That is the rubbish tip. It's the place that Jesus called Gehenna, or hell, the place where they burnt the rubbish outside the city, the place where homeless people would sit and beg. And this man who was so wealthy and successful, there he is, scraping himself, and he's all alone. And then there's just a brief cameo appearance by his wife, verse 9, who says to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. We don't know why she says that. Maybe she just can't bear to see him suffering like that. She wouldn't be the first or the last person who cannot bear to see a loved one suffer and longs for them to die. But whatever it is, Job says to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, here are the markers, and here's the question. Here is a picture of how the world is run. If you're not a Christian believer, it's great to have you here this afternoon. You may be thinking, If that guy at the front thinks he's doing a good marketing job for Christian faith, he's not doing it very well. I want to ask that difficult question the way the Bible asks it. And the way the Bible asks it is to say, here is a man who is a real believer. He lives an upright life in his behavior to other people, and he bows down in thankfulness to the God who's made him. Here is the Satan, who is a real personal force of evil, who causes terrible suffering in the world as it is. Here is God, who is in control, and nothing happens without his permission. And yet he gives these permissions, and there is this innocent suffering. Now you may say, well, where do we go from here? This is a very unsatisfactory start. Maybe somebody is saying, I hoped that coming to this talk, I would get some nice, simple, cut-and-dried answers from Christian people as to how the world is well run, and I haven't, don't seem to have got them. Well, let me say one or two things about this. There are no tidy, cut-and-dried answers, and the Bible doesn't offer them. But just have a look, if you will, on page 3 of the handout at the structure of the book of Job. And I want to say one or two things about the whole book before I draw to a close and invite questions in a couple of minutes. The book is a very long book. There are 42 chapters. It's not a little booklet. And I would encourage you, if you get hold of a Bible, to have a look at it and to get into it. It begins with the prologue, which we've looked at, which is in prose. And there follow chapter after chapter after chapter of raging arguments in poetry. Chapter 3, Job laments, one of the darkest, blackest laments in human literature. And then his three friends, who come to him at the end of chapter 2, engage in cycles of argument. So Eliphaz says something, Job replies, Bildad says something, Job replies, Zophar says something, Job replies. Then they go through the same again. They go through the same again, except they never quite get to the end of the third cycle. Then there's a poem, chapter 28, which we'll look at in the third week. Very important poem. Then Job makes his final defense and says, I really am innocent. Then another character called Elihu comes on and spouts for quite a while. And then God speaks for four chapters, and we'll look at some of that in the last week. And then there's a conclusion. Now, the points I want to make at this stage are this. Job is a very long book, and it's mostly poetry. Well, you say that's not very clever. Anybody looking at the book of Job can tell that. It's obvious. But so what, you say? Well, the answer is so quite a lot. When we ask the question, is the world well run? The answer that God has given us as Christians believe in the book of Job is not a short answer. And Christian people ought never to suggest that there is a short answer. You know, is the world well run? Why do these unfair things happen? Answers on the back of a postcard, please. You know, take a spoonful of the book of Job, add boiling water, and get your instant answer. It's not like that. And God has given us, Christian people believe, a long book in which we grapple with these things and engage with them at length. Now, I sometimes say that this question about whether the world is well run or not may be asked as an armchair question, or what I've called sometimes a wheelchair question, by which I mean this. Sometimes we ask these questions, as it were, in the armchair, and we're not ourselves suffering, and those close to us aren't suffering, and we just ask it because it's useful to discuss it. But sometimes, and for all of us at some stage in our lives, we will ask it, as it were, as the wheelchair question. I mean that metaphorically. When we ourselves are suffering, or those close to us are suffering. And Job is addressed to those who are asking the wheelchair questions from the position of pain. I was discussing this, preparing sermons with some other ministers, and I looked around the little group I was with, and I noticed as they were discussing it that one of the four ministers I know saw his first wife, die in a car accident in their first year of marriage. I know that the second one is bringing up a seriously handicapped daughter. I know that the third one, 7 years ago, broke his neck, came within a millimeter of being quadriplegic or dead. And I know that the fourth one has had repeated radical surgery in his life, which has changed his life. And I looked around and I thought to myself, these are wheelchair questions. These aren't abstract, purely academic questions. Job is a very honest book. And it is mostly poetry. And poetry grapples, if you read it and get into it, for all the puzzles, poetry grapples with our emotions and our wills and our hearts in ways that prose doesn't. And I think it's no accident that it is like that. I remember some years ago I managed to have 24 hours in Florence, and I was going up on the train from Rome in the company of a tourist I bumped into from another country. I won't say which country it was, but this young man was doing a whistle-stop tour of Europe. And he was very pleased to have 24 hours in Florence. That was all he'd planned to have in his 6 months or whatever he was doing Europe. And he said, "Is there anything interesting in Florence?" And I, who'd been reading through my guidebook, wondering how I could possibly do anything much in 24 hours, said, "Yes, there is actually a certain amount in Florence that you can see." And Job is like that. It's a book that we need to live in and read and get into so that it gets under our skin. It's long and it's poetry. You can't do Job in a nutshell. Now, I'm going to stop for questions, but let me just say this as I do. A long time ago, the mystic Christian writer St. Teresa of Avila records how she went through a very long period of darkness and deep depression. And at the end of it, she had what she describes as some kind of vision of God. And as she describes the vision, God says to her, "This is how I always treat my friends." "Then, Lord," she replied, "it is not surprising that you have so few." And there's a certain dark humor in that, isn't there? Because the book of Job does set before us not only how the Lord Jesus Christ suffered and died, but also how every follower of Christ must expect to suffer unjustly. I'm going to stop there for questions. I realize that mostly, so far, the thing consists of questions rather than answers, but I'd be very happy to try to clarify anything I've said. I'm hoping very much that you'll join me next week as we get into seeing Job and his struggles in poetry. We'll be in some of the poetry next week, and then the week after we'll be asking the question, why doesn't God answer my questions? So I'm hoping very much that you'll get into the book of Job, read it in between times, and join me next week if you'd like to. But of course you may well prefer not to, and that would be fine. So let's throw it open for questions. We've got just a few minutes before we finish. Yes, at the back. Thank you very much. That's a very good question. Is God, as it were, like the Greek and Roman gods sitting on Mount Olympus, untouched by human suffering? And one of the things I'm hoping to draw out in the next 2 or 3 weeks is how the figure of Job in his innocent suffering is a foreshadowing of the Lord Jesus Christ, God's Son. And the suffering that Job endures is a picture for us of the suffering of God himself. And I think in a nutshell, that's the pointer to the answer to that. Thank you. Other questions? Anything anyone would like me to try to clarify? I realize it's been a bit quick and hectic. Yes. Yes, thank you. The Bible does teach us that actually at heart we're all sinful. That is to say, no human being loves God with heart, mind, soul, and strength, and loves the neighbor as themselves. The word blameless means something slightly different in Old Testament language. The word blameless is not the deep sinlessness that none of us has and Job can't have had. It speaks, blameless and upright together, speaks of living an upright life with other people, treating them rightly, putting things right when one's done things wrong, and blamelessness of a clear conscience. So it's a life, we might say it's the life of a real believer who will be day by day turning from what's wrong and putting it right, rather than someone who's sinless. I don't know if that helps. That's important, that, because otherwise we would have to say, if we're Christians, we'd have to say Job's claim is wrong. But the writer has signaled those three times at the beginning that he really is blameless and upright. And we'll see as we get into the book that his friends think he's wrong, think he must be wrong, but actually he isn't. Other questions?
Are you saying that all suffering is caused because God's given permission for Satan to cause it?
Well, the book doesn't actually spell that out in those terms, but I guess that probably would be the big Bible answer, that suffering does not happen without God's permission. That is to say, the Christian reading the Bible can't take the easy way out of saying it's not God's fault and God didn't allow it. The Christian must always say, you know, the God of the Bible really is in control. And that even though suffering sometimes puzzles us a lot and pains us a lot, actually God is in control. That's part of the way the book of Job puts it so starkly at the beginning. You've got this horrible Satan, and we expect the Lord to say, no, you can't do that. That would be wrong. But actually, innocent suffering in some way has a rather deep meaning in the history of the universe. Christian people, as I hope I'll show in due course, we'll see that the cross of Christ is where that meaning reaches its peak. But yes, I think, you know, in a nutshell, the answer would be that Christian people would have to say yes. It doesn't happen without God's permission. It makes it harder, doesn't it? Any other questions or comments or objections? Yeah. Yes, I mean, of Job's disasters at the beginning, two of them were crime or terrorism, as we would say, the raids by these guys, the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans. So they were humanly induced suffering. They weren't Job's fault, but they were caused by human beings. The others, of course, the big wind and the storm, the lightning and so on, were what we would call natural disasters. And the question of the origin of that is a deeper and harder one. Does that help? I mean, so there are things in our lives where we suffer where it is our fault. If I get blind drunk and ride my bicycle into a lamppost, to take a trivial example, and hurt myself, that's my fault. You know, there are some things in life which are as simple as that. But most suffering isn't. Most suffering's more complicated than that.